And now I would like to recount for you a joke that I heard when I was a kid. And you'll see why in just a minute. A man walks by a dry cleaner. The dry cleaner is named Fink's Dry Cleaners. And there's a sign in the window. And it reads as follows: "My name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free." So he thinks, this is a good deal. Takes all his clothes, goes in, drops them on the counter. Woman behind the counter says, "They'll be ready Wednesday." Comes back on Wednesday, all his clothes are clean. She says, "That'll be $50. He says, "What do you mean that'll be $50? I saw the sign in the window." She says, "Let me get Mr. Fink for you." Mr. Fink comes out and he says, "What seems to be the problem?" He says, "I see the sign in the window. It says, my name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free. So what's the problem here? Why am I getting a bill for $50? He says, "You didn't read the sign correctly. The sign is, my name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free?" That's how it's read. $50, please. Now, why do I bring this up? Because those of you who subscribe to the weekly email that I send out from my office also get the title of the sermon for the upcoming week. If you don't subscribe, just call my office. We'll be happy to put your email address on the list. And each week on Thursday, we send out the title of the sermon of the coming Shabbos. And usually I try to make it descriptive. So when Robert Mokhtarzadeh called me a couple of weeks ago and said, "We need this sermon title early because we need to put it in the beautifully printed booklet for the Men's Club Shabbat," I had to come up with a title. So the title I came up with was "Iran and Iraq, a Jewish View." This was rather like Fink's sign in his window, because it might lead you to believe that I'm going to talk about a Jewish view of the political situation in Iran and Iraq. But I'm not. I'm actually going to talk about Iran and Iraq, how they figure in Jewish history, and what they mean to us as Jews. So if you were misled by the title, all I can say is you didn't know the joke. But now you know that really a Jewish view of Iran and Iraq is not a view of current political strategies, because we have an ancient history with these lands. So much so that I would guess that almost 95% of all the Jews in the world at one time or another lived in either Iran or Iraq in their family history. Because remember, we know Iraq by another name in Jewish history: Babylonia. And the first exile in 586 BCE was, of course, to Babel, to Babylonia. Let's start with Iraq. I have told the story before, but it is a wonderful story of Ben-Gurion, who, when faced in the early 50s with the Aliyah of Jews from Iraq, came before a class of school children from Iraq and said, "Who is the first Zionist?" Some of them said Herzl, and some of them said Weizmann, and some of them probably said Ben-Gurion, and he said, "No, the first Zionist was an Iraqi Jew. His name was Abraham. Because we came bimakor, in our origin, from that part of the world. And Abraham's journey from Ur Kasdim through Haran was, after all, the journey that many, many Jews took along the Fertile Crescent throughout Jewish history. Our roots in Iraq, we could say, go back farther than the Iraqis, to before there was a Jewish people. Thousands of years. But it's not only in ancient times, and of course, the exile to Iraq, to Babel, which produced the greatest work of post-biblical Jewish writing, which is the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud, which is the authoritative interpreter of the Bible and the creator of the Jewish tradition. But even in medieval times, Iraq was the center of the Jewish world. Baghdad was the most important Jewish community. The academies of Sura and Pumbedita, the great Talmudic academies which carried on Judaism throughout the Middle Ages, were located in what we now think of as Iraq. The head of the Jewish community in Iraq wasn't called the head of the Jewish community of Baghdad. He was called the Resh Galuta. Think of this in Hebrew, Rosh Galut, head of the diaspora, in other words, of all the Jews outside of Israel. The head of the community of Iraq, of Baghdad, was the Resh Galuta. He was the director of Judaism in the diaspora, a title that nobody could claim today. But in the medieval world, there was such a title, and the Gaonim, Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Shmuel Gaon, and many others, who were, again, the shapers of medieval Judaism, the transmitters of our history, who answered questions of Jews from all over the world. They were all located in what we think of as Iraq. A 13th century rabbi, Rabbi Petachia of Regensburg, wrote after traveling through the area, "There is not an unlearned person in all the lands of Babylonia and Assyria. All of them know the 24 books with accurate punctuation and grammar, and each one who is called up to the Torah reads for himself." That's right. Ooh, what a community. What an extraordinary community that he finds in what we now call Iraq. This traveler in the 13th century, he goes on to say that even the Ishmaelites, which is his term, of course, for the Muslims of the 13th century, are trustworthy, and their predominant occupation is the study of Scripture and fear of heaven. All the places that we hear about today, Basra, Karbala, all those cities where people are killed and bombs explode, they were all centers of the Jewish community. They all had synagogues and academies. Once, they were jewels in the crown of our people. When the Mongols conquered Iraq in the 14th century, the Jews persisted. And all along, there were periodic persecutions. There were difficult times and painful times, and we have records of those as well. Jews in Babylonia and later, Jews in a Muslim Iraq did not always fare well, and we have some heartbreaking chronicles of their status as dhimmi, as second-class citizens, and what they endured and forced conversions, depending in part on which Islamic regime was in power. Maimonides, for example, fled the Almohad persecutions in Spain, but he ended up in Egypt, where there was a more tolerant regime. But despite all of this, our roots go very deep. And when we look at Iraq, I don't want us to only think of today, because there was a time when the greatest scholars of our people lived in that land, suffered there, learned there, practiced there, and because of them, we're still here. Now let's turn to Iran, or to Persia. Of course, the Jews of Persia go back to Ezra and Nehemiah and Koresh and Cyrus the Great, who permitted the Jews to return and to rebuild the first temple under Ezra and Nehemiah, which is long enough ago that it is concluded in the Bible. So our roots in Iran go back to biblical times and even perhaps beyond that. The story of Esther, obviously, is the story of the Persian diaspora. And the earliest traditions that we have are the deportation of the Israelites from Samaria under Tiglath-Pileser III, 150 years before the destruction of the first temple. That is, in about the 8th, 9th century BCE. So there have been Jews in Persia that we know of for some 3,000 years. Josephus and the Book of Maccabees both talk about the huge Persian populations, the huge Jewish populations in Persia and Media. Josephus says there are so many, they can't even be estimated. They can't be counted. Shapur I is pictured in the Talmud as having very friendly relations with the famous Rabbi Shmuel. And they talk together. They talk about their dreams in the Talmud. And one beautiful anecdote between the king of Persia and the Talmudic Rabbi Shmuel has Shmuel after dinner. You ready for this? This is one of the most eminent rabbis in the Talmud. What does he do after dinner for the king of Persia? He juggles wine glasses. Something very few rabbis can do today. It was hatred of Rome, as you might expect, that drew the Persian and the Jewish populations together. It doesn't appear that Zoroastrianism was directed against Judaism in any serious way. It is one of those ancient traditions that does not seem to have a long tradition of anti-Jewish prejudice, although there is an exception in the 5th century for reasons that are not clear and that scholars still debate. Even in the Jewish Middle Ages, when the great fight inside Jewry was between the rabbinic Jews, that's all of us, and the Karaites, those who rejected rabbinic tradition, the leaders of the Karaite community, many of them came from Persia as well. Which means that not only was there a flourishing community, there was also a vital, arguing Jewish community inside of what we now call Iran. Through the Ilkhan dynasty and the conquest of Tamerlane and the Safavid dynasty and so on, all of it, the Persian community kept alive. And then I found, in this anthology called The Jewish Caravan, published in the 1930s by the Jewish Publication Society, a section from the travels of Binyamin II. You know, Binyamin of Tudela, the travels of Binyamin in the early Middle Ages, is a famous chronicle of Jews throughout the world. Well, this Binyamin II traveled in the 1800s. He was born in Moldova in 1818. And the section here is Adventures in Shiraz and Isfahan in the 1800s. A few pages about what he saw there. In Isfahan, well, first of all, let me start in Shiraz, where he talks about the Jewish community and a terrible incident involving the suicide of a young girl who refused to convert and marry a Muslim. And then in Isfahan, he goes on and tells of a famous dancer, Aga Babi, who became friendly, so distinguished was he in the arts. He actually, what Binyamin says was he was so distinguished in the arts, people forgot he was a Jew. He was that distinguished. He became a friend of the Shah, and he eventually converted to reach a high station in the government. And from there, he spent his career in the government protecting the Jewish people. Every way that he could, and even after he left the government, he still would work behind the scenes to protect the Jews in Isfahan. And in fact, when Benjamin was writing, he was still alive. He was an old man. He was no longer in the government, but he still worked to protect the Jewish people. So why do I bring all this up? I bring it up for a couple of reasons. First of all, because we should remember. We should remember what these lands meant to us in our history, and those who lived there, and what they endured. Because we tend to forget very quickly once we're gone. And that's the second thing we should remember, is that in our day, thousands of years of history are over. Yes, there are still vestigial communities in Iran and Iraq, but the flourishing of Jewish life in those two countries that had Jewish life in them for thousands of years is gone. It didn't end overnight as it did in Eastern Europe. But it ended over the course of just a few decades. And we shouldn't forget both the glory and also the pain. Because the pain of living in Iran and Iraq for the Jewish people is why it's important to mention it on Pesach. Pesach is a story that Jews have reenacted again and again. We can imagine, after the Exodus from Egypt, that there were Jews who said, we lived there for hundreds of years. And that was true. We can imagine that there were Jews who said, we had some very wonderful times. The time of Joseph, we were a flourishing nation, and that's true. When the Jews first came to Egypt, don't forget, they were associated with the vice pharaoh. But as they left, the wiser heads must also have said, and yet, we were never fully free there. And that also is true. The same thing was true in Babylonia, in ancient Persia, and then in Iran and Iraq. I wonder, as I know all of you do, what is it that turned periodic persecutions in our day into such virulent hatred? And here is at least one theory. It's a theory you can apply for a long time to Christian Europe, and one you could apply today to the Muslim Middle East, which is that Jews were tolerable in the world as long as they were not sovereign over themselves. But once they became sovereign over themselves, they were a theological threat. It's what we see in the story of Egypt. The Pharaoh worries that there will be too many of them, and then they won't be subject to his rule anymore. And now in the world, there is a Jewish community that is sovereign over itself. And the Exodus, like the ancient Exodus, is to a place where Jews won't have to suffer what Benjamin saw in the 1800s and what his predecessors remembered. Remember that our accomplishments were in spite of our suffering, not because of it. When people say the Jews succeeded because they had such a hard time, first of all, they should remember that a lot of people had a hard time and they're not here anymore. So it isn't true that suffering keeps you alive. Second, the Jewish people have accomplished more in the second half of the 20th century, when they were finally free, than they could in the centuries before that. As Elie Wiesel says, the idea that suffering is good for Jews is one that owes its popularity to our enemies. But here is the Pesach message. Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik says in some ways the most remarkable thing about what happened on Passover is what we did on the last night before we left, celebrating the Pesach. Because a people that had suffered slavery for hundreds of years, what would you expect that they would wish to do to those who had enslaved them? To take revenge. But instead of going out and taking revenge on the slave masters, on those who'd been cruel, against those who had, after all, persecuted the Jewish people for hundreds of years, they stayed inside and praised God. Israel is surrounded by countries that, after all, not only confiscated untold wealth over the years from the Jewish people, but despite our service to those nations, treated us periodically with terrible and often unrecorded persecution. And yet, all the modern state of Israel really wants is to be left alone in peace. It is not a vengeful state and not a cruel one. Instead, it embodies the spirit of the Pesach. The spirit of the Pesach is to remember, as we remember Egypt, to remember all the lands from which we came, in which our ancestors lived, in which they learned, and in which they suffered. But not to allow that to make us vengeful, but rather to allow us to pray and to hope that the spirit of the Pesach, which is one of liberation, of freedom, and of peace, will spread throughout the world, and that in the future we will be able to say a Jewish view of the lands of Persia and Babylonia, and everybody will know that what we are about to learn is history. Shabbat Shalom.